Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm Detroit Economic Club welcome for Jeff Korzenek.
Thank you for that very generous introduction. If I could just clarify one point, I was invited, not subpoenaed, to testify in Capitol Hill. I thought that's an important distinction. Before I get going, I wanted to thank two of my colleagues, Dave Girardot, our regional president for Eastern Michigan, for his support over the years and bringing me here, and then a newer colleague, Ruben Rashti, who heads our Michigan wealth management practice. He also nationally heads our multifamily office, and I'm delighted here at the Townsend to say that he will be opening a new wealth management office for us just around the corner here in Birmingham. So thank you to my colleagues. I also, there are some members of the Economic Club that I should thank, but in case I bomb, I'm going to save that for later so I don't embarrass them. Let me just jump in the interest of time, to our the starting point for us is the economic cycle. We're long in the tooth. We believe we're in the eighth inning of this economic cycle. So what's going to bring it to an end? It's outlasted most other cycles in the U.S. Fundamentally, we believe the U.S. economy is running out of labor. This chart is a long-term chart of the unemployment rate in the U.S. It's the headline rate of unemployment. Those vertical gray bars that you see in the picture are periods of recession. And as you'll see, when you get to very low levels of unemployment and you get to very tight labor markets, the end of the expansion tends to follow somewhat quickly. Now, it's very difficult to say how low can you go. In the 50s, we got down to a 2.5% unemployment rate. We got into the high threes in the heights of the dot-com frenzy. But we tend to believe at Fifth Third that if we are not actually at full employment, we're very, very close. And that represents some unique challenges for economy as well as for investors. The usual means of transmission to ending the cycle when labor gets tight is rising wages, which ultimately spread to more general inflation and cause an increase in interest rates. We got a whiff of that with the February 2nd release of average hourly earnings, surprised the markets, caused a lot of, or at least triggered a lot of the volatility. We don't think this cycle is over by any means, but we see some challenges in sight. So we wanted to quantify just what do we need to keep this cycle going. If you look at almost the whole history of this expansion since 2009, we've been adding, and more radically at first, more consistently in more recent years, we've been adding about 200,000 net new workers every month. That's the non-farm payrolls report that you hear at the beginning of every month. Where do they come from? Well, you have to start with, we get some from immigration, and we get some from natural demographic growth of the U.S. economy, more millennials coming in than baby boomers going out. Well, they're responsible for about 96,000. So that leaves a shortfall, and you annualize that shortfall, we need about 1.25 million net new workers to keep going. So that's what it means to not run out of workers. We need 1.25. Now, when the unemployment rate was 6, 7, 8, 9%, it's pretty easy to find those workers. You'll find people with good skills match, you may know them, good work histories, and you can bring them back in. But at full employment, where can you go? Obviously, immigration is one possible solution. Who here thinks immigration numbers are going up in the US? Okay. We're all on the same page. The only other solution is to draw people off of the sidelines. And that's where this metric, the labor force participation rate, becomes so important. This, again, we go back to the start of this data collected in 1948. And what you'll see is we benefited in the U.S. economy through those middle years, the 80s and 90s, from a rapid growth in labor force participation rates. The secret sauce to U.S. economic growth, one of the major reasons we grew so quickly, was because we had a growing percentage of the adult population in the labor force. And the real secret there was rising female labor force participation rates. But we peaked out. There's only a level you can get to, and we peaked out around 2000, and it's been falling since. But the fall accelerated as it typically would be expected to do following the recession of 08-09. But it hasn't come back. And for us to continue our expansion, we need to raise the level of labor force participation in the U.S. economy. Some of this decline is natural. It's the exit of the baby boomers. They're just retiring out of the workforce, and not and we're getting some benefit of millennials coming in, but much of the decline, perhaps half of that decline from 2000 on, was baby boomers leaving. But there's another component that has not been well explained, and it probably means if you compare using gender history by gender and by age cohort, what should be the labor force participation rate today? It suggests to us and to others who've analyzed this that we are missing 2 or 3 million workers in the U.S. economy. That's a good 2 years of additional growth that's missing. If you ask our political class, both parties, they are convinced that all we have to do is get the labor markets going a little faster, growth going a little faster, maybe a few training programs, and this problem will take care of itself. And in fact, traditionally, the response to faster growth rates and tighter labor markets was to see a rise in labor force participation rates. We think that animated the policies across all levels of government. The definitive economic paper on this was actually co-written by former Fed Chair Janet Yellen. There's only one problem. It's not working. And we at Fifth Third started digging deeper into this and asked ourselves, who's on the sidelines? And we came to the conclusion that it is going to be extraordinarily difficult to bring people off the sidelines. Because unlike every past cycle in modern economic American history, we have three social ills that are presenting major barriers to raising the labor force participation rate. The first one is that unlike past cycles, we really saw a huge increase in long-term unemployment. There are two versions of this. I'll just, in the interest of time, focus on one way of looking at the metric. That's the chart at the, That's the chart at the left, which is the average duration of unemployment. This goes back to 1948. You'll see there, you know, ups and downs in that number. The peaks represent periods of recession or the aftermath of recession. It just makes sense. If you lose your job in a recession, it takes you longer to get back in. The critical question is, how much longer? Well, those peaks usually represented average durations of unemployment of 15 or 20 weeks. But look what happened in the aftermath of 08-09. We got up to about 41 weeks average duration of unemployment by 2011. People who lost their job, got out of work, had tremendous difficulty getting back in work. And the problem with this is we have all sorts of evidence from any number of studies that points to the longer you're out of work, the more likely you are to simply drop out of the labor force. And many of the people who have been sidelined, and even here we are today in our ninth year of our economic expansion with the best GDP growth we've seen in many, many years, with extraordinarily tight labor markets, and we still have an average duration of unemployment that's above past peaks. It tells you we have a problem. What you don't see are all the people who have simply dropped out, aren't even in the statistic, and have been out of work for 3, 4, or 5 years. We would suggest that in all likelihood, this won't be a resource. People who are still struggling to get back in, there may be something in the background, and we'll talk about what that could be, that's preventing them from getting back in. If they have been sidelined for 3, 4, or 5 years, if you're in technology, your skills are largely obsolete. If you were in something where we need jobs like construction and manufacturing, you've been out, it's unlikely you're physically able to do the job. And we have all sorts of statistics, again, from other studies, one most notably by the Brookings Institute, that show that even if you come back in, if you've been out for a long time, it's unlikely to stick, and you're more likely to drop out. So this, to us, is one of the big barriers to raising labor force participation rates. But it gets worse. We started looking to try to get clues at this, at demographics that tend to be very consistent and have very high levels of labor force participation rates. We wanted to get rid of the baby boomer element, and we wanted to get rid of people still in college. So we looked at the 25 to 34-year-old demographic. That's the chart on the left. The green line along the bottom goes with the right-hand axis for that chart. That's female labor force participation rates going to 2000. It goes up and down as labor markets picked up. More women got back in the workforce. And it behaved fairly traditionally. But take a look at the blue line, and that goes with the scale on the left, the left-hand axis. Young men, 25 to 34-year-old men, are typically almost all in the workforce. And even though labor markets have gotten more robust, and even though there is a crying need for people to fill occupations that are often filled by young men, think construction, manufacturing, the labor force participation rate is still on the bottom. We put this together with all sorts of anecdotal evidence and the chart on the right. And for the last 2 years or so at Fifth Third, we've been talking about the opioid epidemic and the terrible tragedy that this means, not just to families, but the problem it's causing on an economic level as well. And we think that this is the single biggest barrier to raising the labor force participation rate in the U.S. Let's talk about some of these numbers, and I apologize for this very, very depressing element here. This is usually where we want the open bar component. So this data comes from 2016. That's when we get the updates are somewhat far in arrears, and they probably understate the numbers. So we had over 63,000 overdose deaths in the United States, the majority of which are opioid-related. Look at how that compares to, it's greater than the number of people we lost in the Vietnam War through the whole course of the war. It's greater than the peak of the AIDS epidemic, far greater than the peak of the crack epidemic. It is more than we lose through gun deaths in the United States. It's more than we lose in car deaths, and again, it's understated. If you look, for instance, in car crash deaths in the United States, for the first time, about 2 years ago, for the first time, drug intoxication as a cause of accidents overtook alcohol intoxication. There's also a huge stigma associated with overdose deaths, so some of them go underreported or misreported. This is an American tragedy, but it's also an economic problem, because it's not just the overdose deaths. Those are the tip of the iceberg. And I'd also, just to back up one slide, take a look at the rate of acceleration on the right-hand side of overdose deaths. It's the pipeline of people who are abusing drugs behind this that is going to continue driving these overdeaths up. And when you get to the number of people in the workforce who are abusing opioids or in the population, that's where you start to understand that this is an economic problem as well as a social tragedy. To put some perspective on it, we have a workforce of about 150 million people, big round numbers. The Department of Health and Human Services estimates that 11.5 million Americans are abusing opioids, taking opioids for non-medicinal purposes. Of those, more than 2 million would meet the definition of what we think of as addicts. This is keeping people out of the workforce. Obviously, when you talk 11.5 million people, some of them are in the workforce. It certainly precludes them from a whole host of occupations, particularly occupations that are fruitful for people without a college degree in manufacturing, transportation, construction, things where you need to be able to pass a drug test. It also, those who are in the workforce often then are underemployed because they can't go into these jobs. They're often underemployed because they're not very productive. I think it's very hard to argue someone that's abusing drugs on a regular basis is a terribly productive worker. And then, of course, many of these people are wholly out of the workforce. And it's a very difficult path for us as a society to get these people back in, particularly at a time when we still are growing that 11.5 million base. We're maybe just now starting to stop the growth of it, but addressing the people who are users and abusers and addicts of opioids is very, very difficult. Just to give you one statistic. It takes you, if you are ready for rehab and are successful in your rehab, you have to stay off of opioids for 2 years, two full years before your brain chemistry returns to normal. It's a very, very formidable barrier. So this is the biggest challenge that we see. And of course, all these things are tied together. Long-term unemployment is correlated with abuse of alcohol and abuse of drugs. And then use of drugs is correlated with crime. This is an area where I still have some fairly dark news to share, but this is one where we actually see some opportunity to make things better. In the U.S., rates of incarceration started to rise a little bit in the 80s, but particularly in the 90s. And in fact, we got the levels of incarceration, as you can see here, that for which there's hardly any comparison in the developed world. You have to start talking about countries like Rwanda and Russia before you get comparable levels of incarceration. And this is not about sentencing reform. That's not my area of expertise. I think we all know we live in a fairly dangerous society. People have to have consequences who commit crime. But our point is maybe those consequences should not be lifetime, because there is an enormous barrier. Once you have, whether you've been incarcerated or not, once you have an arrest and a conviction on your record, those are huge barriers to employment. And this is where we see some hopeful signs. In a market where we are in an environment where we're running out of labor, here's what we see ultimately as an opportunity. Let's put some numbers on it. Again, we're talking 150 million workforce in the U.S. Well, we have about 2.3, 2.4 million people who are currently incarcerated. Okay, they're out of the labor force. That's not even counted in those labor force statistics. But they will be. Many of them will be coming out. Who's come out and is in probation and parole, you add that number in, you're talking about over 7 million Americans. Here's an astounding number. How many Americans have a felony conviction? 19 million. Why? Now, one of the things that when I speak to business audiences and we talk about the opportunity to bring these people into the workforce, it's really, we have to understand what a felony can be. When you say felony conviction, right, you think axe murderer, right? Let's face it. Here's things that can get you a felony conviction in the United States, and I'm not saying any of these things are admirable. By way of background, I should add I'm the father of young men. They're still boys to me, 20 and 23. I'm convinced, and there's actually some medical evidence, that every 20-year-old male is congenitally stupid. I was stupid at 20. I'm working out of it. My boys are stupid. They're working out of it, I hope. And courtesy of my wife, our boys are watched like hawks. But young men in particular, and young people of any age, any gender, any age, can make stupid mistakes. The question is, what should be the consequences of those mistakes? In Illinois, I live in the city of Chicago, in Illinois, if a dumb 18-year-old goes for a joyride on a stolen bicycle, and that bicycle is worth more than $301, that can be a felony. Child support. A young person gets someone pregnant, owes child support, falls behind, that can be a felony. I know of a young woman in New York City, 19 years old, maybe 20 years old, who was out on a date. She had two fake IDs to try to get a drink. They got stopped. The two fake IDs came to light. In New York State, two fake IDs with intent to defraud, that is, get a drink at a bar when you're underage. She was arrested for a felony and encouraged to plead guilty. She wasn't going to serve time, but the prosecutor could notch up a felony conviction. Fortunately, she was part of a nonprofit. It's run by a friend of mine who, very successful Wall Streeter, who called in a favor from one of New York's top criminal attorneys who showed up at court with her. The judge looked up and saw this attorney and said, "What are you doing here?" And they were able to work it out. But for so many, they don't work it out. And obviously, felonies run the gamut of things from very violent crimes to these kind of things that maybe we don't consider in the same light. There's another number that's often quoted out there, 70 million. This is the most widely quoted number. President Obama had used this number. I hesitate to use it because I think it's a little bit overblown. This comes from state databases, and technically it means 70 million Americans have had interaction with the criminal justice system. So that can mean, in some states, tax liens. In some states, even driving. The reason I don't like to use this number, if I tell you that 70 million Americans have arrest records, which is how it's usually portrayed, even though that's not it, and you don't know someone who's been arrested, you're thinking, boy, the people who live over there must all be criminals. And I think it promotes the wrong vision. But even here, this includes people who are arrested but not guilty. And that might mean that if you had a mugshot taken, you're picture might appear on mugshots.com, which is a site that is used often in looking into employee background checks. Mugshots.com does not take your mugshot down if you are innocent. You can petition and work on it. It can cost you as much as $15,000 to have it removed. So this 70 million, the true answer of who's impaired by past interaction with the criminal justice system is somewhere between 19 million and 70 million, probably closer, you know, somewhere in the middle. That's a big number. And obviously, many of these people are in the workforce, but again, I would argue that many of them are underemployed. Now, one of the benefits of being in a tighter labor market is you do have, companies are starting to break down those barriers and look beyond. And that's a very hopeful thing. Recent headlines, this is just in the last couple of months, New York Times headlines, Washington Post headline, Boston Globe, others across our footprint. This is really good news because it means that businesses are open to considering it. There's good and bad news here. And what I really want to share with you today is that if you just go out there and hire someone with a criminal background, it may work or it may not work. And if it doesn't work, when we get through our natural business cycle, another recession will come at some point, and maybe the unemployment rate goes up to 6 or 7%. If it's not working out, who's going to be the first out the door? And what will you as a business decision maker say, that didn't work out, never again? But there are models, and this is what's really exciting for us at Fifth Third and what we want to share with the business community in general and here in Detroit, is that there are private sector models, companies that have cracked the code and figured out ways to bring in ex-offenders into the workforce successfully and as a business strategy. These are for-profit companies. I got a clue that there was something here when I talked to someone in Western Michigan is one of the real centers of this, and they tell me how they did it, and then I was in Charlotte, and someone would tell me how they did it, and then someone in Cincinnati told me how they did it with their company, and they all had what to me looked like the same model. So there is a model of success. It takes three actors, government, nonprofits, and the private sector. And so what I'd like to walk through is the model as we see it that works, and some policies that we believe could be productive for encouraging this model, and the many benefits, of course, include extending our economic expansion, but also think of the societal good that we can do as well by breaking this incarceration and recidivism cycle that not just hurts individuals but hurts their families and the communities of these repeat offenders. So let's start out what it looks like from the employer perspective. They need to be willing to consider this, but they also need to be willing to source and support their employees in a slightly different way. I've spoken to people who are active in the prison system recently, someone from the North Carolina state prison system, and she gave me an estimate that really is true. We don't have any real hard numbers here. If you take a look at who's coming out of prisons, about a third of them could go right into employment right away. They're ready. About a third need work. They need to be taught soft skills. They might need anger management programs. I am told that you should handle difficult situations and anger differently in the workforce than you do in prison. and people don't know. So they need to be taught some of these skills. They might need help with housing. They might need help with getting a driver's license. To get that, you need a birth certificate, or you need a social security number. All these things that require a lot of support and are formidable barriers. And then a third need that, and a third of the people probably will never be ready for employment. I don't know, no one has a hard number. Those ring true to me from the experience. So who's going to provide those soft skills and that kind of support? Nonprofits. In every market, there are some nonprofits that do wonderful, wonderful work in this. And critically, from the standpoint of a business owner who's looking at sourcing employees, they know who's ready for employment and who's not. And so partnering is critically important. And then many of these people also need some special help because they come from backgrounds of challenges. And if you come out of prison and you have $100 and a bus ticket, as happens in some states, you need some more support. So for instance, this screenshot is from grsource.org. 16 companies in the western part of this state have banded together, and they've essentially created like a private social worker network that supports employees. Think of it as an extension of your EAP plan, Employee Assistance Program, Employee Assistance Plan. We found from employers telling me that when they put these in place, for second chances for ex-offenders, that all their employees end up benefiting from it, and it's really been a very great, it's been a terrific retention tool. You might need your managers to be trained a little bit different. Cascade Engineering, I believe they're based in Holland, but they're in four or five states as well as Europe, 1,600 employee firm. They train all their supervisors by putting them through a poverty simulation. What does that mean? Well, it means that when an employee calls up who comes from a challenged background and says, I guess I can't work again because my car broke and it's a $300 repair, old school supervisor, show up tomorrow, don't bother showing up again. Someone trained might understand that this employee doesn't have $300 in the bank, doesn't have credit, and might say, hey, Joe's in the next town over, he's gonna pick you up the next week, and I'll call the car repair shop and tell him you're good for it. So we see things like microloans and things like that being done. So what's in it for the employer? Well, beyond just staffing, it turns out that you actually get, when you follow this model, you partner with a nonprofit, you offer a little bit of specialized support, you actually get not just an employee, you get a very good employee, and one with very low turnover rates and very dedicated. Nehemiah Industries, Nehemiah Manufacturing in Cincinnati is one of the pioneers. Half of their 180 employees are second chancers, ex-offenders. Their receptionist is a former madam. She's very friendly, good skills, transference. And they have hired people with all sorts of backgrounds and done it successfully. And the CEO, Dan Myers, provided these numbers to me. The cost of turnover is a major cost of doing business, sourcing and turnover employees. He believes that they have added over 5% to cash flow through populating their workforce using this model. It's a for-profit business. We've banked them. It is not a nonprofit, it's a for-profit business. We see also some other data, we've seen data from other employers. There's a study that suggests that these workers, again, when you source them correctly and support them correctly, are more productive than other workers. Johns Hopkins has been a leader in hiring ex-offenders into their healthcare system. They have a terrific track record of success as well. So this is not, there is evidence and good evidence to suggest that when you do this right, it's worth the time and investment for the process. Clearly, nonprofits have to play their part. For one, they have to look at the world a little bit differently. They traditionally tend to view their clients, the people in their programs, and be advocates for them. They also have to keep in mind now that they have stakeholders. Of employers. And so the Safer Foundation in Chicago, this is a screenshot from their website, has gone and worked with industries and said, who's growing their workforce? How can we help prepare them for you? One of the mistakes that we've heard of in the nonprofit community, for instance, is that when employers have asked nonprofits, not Safer really gets this, but some other nonprofits that are newer to this, have asked them to send candidates, instead of sending the person who is most ready for employment, they send the person in greatest need, whether they're ready or not. That's very short-sighted, obviously. If that doesn't work out, that employer will, of course, say never again. But Safer Foundation is a leader in this and partnering with businesses and looking at businesses as at least stakeholders, if not their client. Government has a role to play. There's been great work particularly done in Ohio where Governor Kasich started a bipartisan commission to address this, and they've done some things that lower barriers to employment. Licensing requirements is a big one. So they have workarounds for licensing requirements. You can't, in most states, you can't be a barber if you have a felony offense. Okay, I get it if you're convicted of scissor murder, right? But you know, if you were a felon because of you fell behind when you were young and dumb in child support payments or just hit, you know, the recession, should that really preclude you from that kind of career opportunity? So there are things that many states have pursued in terms of lowering barriers. There's some federal legislation talking about this as well, getting around licensing restrictions and lowering liability. States are split on this. If someone has truly paid their dues and done their time, should an employer have any extra liability for hiring them than he has for any other employee? Some states yes, some states no. Real briefly, I'll mention there's some supplementary models as well. Here, transitional employment in Chicago. I've worked with the North Lawndale Employment Network. They hire people for 3 months at a time and make them beekeepers. And they sell honey and honey-infused cosmetics. The founder of it, Brenda Palms Barber, got a MacArthur Genius Grant for this. And then they, 3 months of experience showing up on time, acting responsibly, the manufacturers in that area turned to her and her program for their workers. Incarceration work experience. This is a little tricky subject. You know, there's been abuse, obviously, of prison labor in the past. There's some great models. IBM Envelope outside of Cincinnati has just put a printing press in one of the local prisons. They're not producing product there. It's purely training. One of their former employees who kind of ran afoul of the law is actually going to be one of the trainers there. And so they're hiring people who come out the prison doors. There's been some interesting work done in Kansas. There's a host of companies. One I spoke to in Leavenworth, Kansas, or exchanged emails with the CEO, Zephyr Industries, hires people while they are in prison. They get on a bus, they come to the factory. They typically do it for about 3 years. Their recidivism rate, national recidivism rates after 3 years, is about 40%. People are back in jail. For people who graduate their program, 5%. They're paid minimum wage. They do have some payback for their rent of being in jail. The health care is picked up by the state. Some of them have victim restitution to pay. But ultimately, they are required to save 10% of what remains. They walk out of jail, or prison in that case, with work experience and money in the bank. That's not a bad model. Advanced professional training, you may hear of in Cleveland, Edwin's Leadership Institute and Restaurant. You may hear of them because there's a documentary just done about them called Knife Skills, which is a nominee for Academy Award for a short documentary. They have produced 201 graduates. These are not just burger turners. This is a six-month culinary training program. To be admitted to the program, you have to have been incarcerated. They've graduated 201 graduates over 3.5-4 years. The recidivism rate is less than 1%. It's phenomenal. And then finally, entrepreneurships in Chicago. There's Sunshine Ministries and others. It's a tougher one because of licensing restrictions, but it perhaps can provide some supplemental income. One thing I'll stress, and I know I'm running low on time here, is that a lot of policies that have come out of Washington speak to the large companies, big corporations. That's not who's hiring. We really have to address the needs of small businesses, and it's very different. They're often family-owned. Spoke to a CEO of one company who said, look, I inherited this business from my father. I want my kids, my son and my daughter, to work here. It's a legacy. They want it to be safe and they want it to be secure. So a bad hire, as many of you know, can cause a lot of destruction. And so we really have to be respectful of those risks of small business owners. Why is it so important to target them? That's where the jobs are. 43% of all jobs created in the past, during most of this cycle for which we have data, was from very small businesses. Most of the rest was a little bit larger. Large corporations don't produce that many jobs. So let's go to where the opportunity is and target our policies. Real quickly, some policy proposals. Spreading the model. Organizations should have businesses who are doing this already talk to other businesses. That's much more credible. If you understand the model needs an employer willing to hire and a nonprofit that understands their role in this, go try and find a database of that. It doesn't exist. So I've had employers say, I'm willing to do this. I said, let me match you with a nonprofit. I can't find who's doing this. So they're out there. I think the arts community has a role. Everyone has a role to play. There's a play out there. I've spoken to the playwright that talks about it. Builds empathy, lets you think about people who are ex-offenders in a different way. I shared this with the executives of the Harris Theater, where I'm on the board in Chicago. They said, we can do better. We're a dance theater. Dance and classical music, kind of hard to integrate storytelling of ex-offenders, but we'll hire some. So they've partnered with one of the great workforce development agencies in CARA, in Chicago, called CARA. They've hired their first ex-offender. And moreover, they're treating ex-offenders as part of the community. So people who are graduates of this workforce program are going to get blocks of free tickets to performances. It's part of our community, and we should view that. Removing barriers, incenting, not punishing employers. Here's what I didn't mention. I did not mention ban the box. This has been the universal fix-all, don't let employers ask up front. The academic evidence for ban the box is not good. It suggests it helps in some areas, it harms in other areas, and the net, on net, it probably hurts more than it harms. Yet this is still I had a nonprofit tell me, well, this is the best practices. I don't understand how, and I'm not against it, I just think we should stop and study it more because the initial studies aren't very helpful. I also don't mention tax credits and transitional employment support, not because they're not important, but it should be understood as just one of the tools and not a fix-all. If someone is doing this, I had an employer in Western Michigan say he went to a presentation on this, and all they talked about were the tax credits you can get from hiring an ex-offender, and he said, if you're in it for that, it's not going to work. And then, very last slide. And I apologize for running a little bit older. What's the cost of inaction? If we need 1.25 million workers each year, what happens if we don't find them? It's going to be tough to find them in the 11.5 million opioid abusers. Yes, we can do much better there, but that's a hard slog. It's also a hard slog, but I think one we can do better on. We get on the prisons each year, 600,000 or 700,000 people, maybe prisons plus jails. No one really knows. We don't have great statistics. 1.5 million. Within 5 years, at least out of state prisons, over 76% are rearrested. What a waste of human potential and economic potential. We're a $19 trillion economy, conservatively, growing at 2% a year. Each year of economic growth is worth $380 billion. If we run out of labor, because of these social ills, we're going to cut this expansion off by 1 or 2 years. Each year we forego is worth $380 billion. Not someone else's money, all of our money. With that, let me say thank you and open it up for some questions. So.
Thank you, Jeff. Outstanding information and presentation. Thank you. So lots of questions. Let me start with, you gave a lot of great companies and states that are doing great work in putting ex-offenders back to work. Let's take it up a notch. Are there some countries that you can think of that do a great job of that?
So it's interesting. In the U.S., we're very divided on, and again, we're a more violent society than most of the developed world. So I think we have to be respectful of that. But Europe generally looks on prison and includes a big rehabilitation component. In the Netherlands, I'm trying to track this down, but I'm told that companies are actually expected and maybe have some requirements or benefits, and I'm not sure I would go this direction, to require to hire a certain percent of ex-offenders. The Scandinavian countries tend to be very focused on work opportunities and people coming in and out of jail, or, you know, coming home at night to jail and working out. So there's a lot of models that I think we could learn from, being respectful of the differences in violence rates.
Good, thank you. Question about labor force participation rate. How does it take the gig/freelance economy into consideration?
So there is obviously a gray component of the economy, people who aren't reporting, but say if you're an Uber driver or a Lyft driver, that's reported. So that's all counted in there as part of the labor force participation rate.
Great. We could go a lot of ways. There's a lot of question about the recent stock market volatility. So let's just do real broad. Do you care to comment?
Sure. No. So to keep myself honest, I go back and see what I wrote, so I don't pretend I was, you know, got this right beforehand. And sometimes I had wishful thinking, sometimes I don't. But I did look back in late October. I was on Squawk Box on CNBC, for those of you who watch that network. And I was kind of pushing back on the bullishness because I said, this is a market that it's not that it's priced for perfection, but it is not taking into account the possibility of inflation. Everyone got caught up in this long-term secular story of disinflation. We'll never have inflation again because of globalization, technology, and the aging of the world's population. Yes, those suppress inflation, but you have still have cycles we have, and we've long been on the lookout for a cyclical rebound. That perhaps was the trigger for this when we saw wages, the surprising increase in wages. But fundamentally, the underlying economy looks good. This is a valuation issue. One of our watchwords this year, we've sort of had this overarching theme we start each year. This year, with apologies to the songwriter Bobby McFerrin, it's do worry, be happy. Be happy because we're really in for a good solid year of growth in the U.S. economy. Do worry because we're closer to the end of the cycle and those stresses and strains, like having to incorporate the possibility of inflation or running out of labor, are things that make a rockier road for investors.
Great, thank you. Corporate tax reform. I know you talked to the students earlier, and you told them that on the report card you gave them a certain grade. Do you care to share that?
So we broke the tax reform into two elements. There's an individual tax reform, which we gave a D plus. It's, you know, obviously some of us benefit, some of us don't benefit. I'm trying to get over the fact that the loss of state and local tax deduction is particularly acute for those of us who live in Chicago and pay both high property taxes and high income taxes. But the reality is the individual tax code didn't simplify it. In some ways, it makes it more complex. And we think that the loss of state and local tax deduction or limitations on that is a potentially very negative disruption element. You know, if you're the state of Connecticut or my hometown of Hartford, Connecticut, which is already exploring bankruptcy options, these are real problems that may be caused. So we gave a D plus to individual, but I gave I gave a B plus to corporate, because U.S. companies were severely disadvantaged relative to our global competitors. We simply didn't have a competitive corporate tax code. And what that meant is it incented U.S. companies to hold trillions, literally trillions of dollars abroad rather than bring it and invest it in the United States. And it also incented U.S. companies to have more employees abroad than hiring Americans. So that seemed it seemed like something very, very overdue. And I think in many ways they've helped it.
Great. I do want to get a student question in. We're going to get outside the box here a little bit from the topic, but I thought it was interesting a student would ask this. Any consensus among your peers on cryptocurrency market? Do you think it's stable or just a bubble? Any comment on that?
So distributed networks and the blockchain is for real. It's important. It's going to have all sorts of interesting outcomes. I have a real tough time with cryptocurrencies, and anytime you hear, so I'm a New Englander, and those of you from Northern Michigan would appreciate this too. We use skiing analogies. What are the most dangerous words in skiing? Dad, follow me. What's the most dangerous words in investing? This time it's different. And I kept hearing too many people tell me, this time it's different, this isn't a bubble. I think cryptocurrencies may have some value but is probably well below where they're trading today.
Great. Okay, we've met Jeff, the businessman. How about Jeff, the personal guy? So we're going to play lightning round, quick machine gun style. Are you ready?
Yeah, I guess
so. All right, give me something on your bucket list.
I've never been to Venice. I really want to go to Venice.
Love it. A person you would like to have lunch with?
Okay, this says nothing about my political preference. I'd like to have lunch with President Trump because I think he's a really odd guy, and I'd like to assess him personally. And this is nothing about my politics or his policies. I just, you know, that's the kind of person you want to meet in person to figure out what he really is about.
Let me know how that goes.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, right.
Favorite team growing up?
Oh, I'm raised in Hartford, Connecticut. Half the street was Yankee fans. We don't talk to them. Red Sox. So.
I know you're in a book club. Give me a book that you love.
We just read The Rent Collector, which is a wonderful book based in a Cambodian dump, based on some true stories. A wonderful book.
Great. And one final one, and you can take a little more time with us. Advice to your 25-year-old self.
Well, I wouldn't have listened. but I'll tell you what I tell 25-year-olds. I speak to a lot of universities, and I have what I call my scared straight talk, which is essentially bad things that happen to good people's careers. And it's based on basically three guidelines. And although I might not have listened when I was 25, I hope some of them do listen. Number one, manage your brand so that you're known and have earned the brand of hard work and integrity. Number two, an obvious corollary to that is always do the right thing, which sounds so easy until it might threaten your job or your ability to pay a mortgage or rent to do the right thing. And number three, I don't like the term networking. I like helping others along the way. And you never know when it's going to get paid back. We all know that this is an economy that's volatile. It's unlikely to change. Help others because you might be next.
Well, I want to thank you for helping us understand this difficult situation here with the workforce. Ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Porzenik. I also want to express my appreciation for the folks at Fifth Third for making this possible and for the support. David Jarrett, Ruben Rashti, Colleen Scott, I know you're out there. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being with us. One more time for Jeff Porzenik, please. Happy Punchy Day. This meeting is adjourned.